Welcome to the Hobcast Book Show, a weekly podcast from Hobeck Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, mystery, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of running a creative business in this challenging world. We'll hear from the people who make this possible, the authors, the cover designers and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on the Hobcast Book Show from Hobeck Books, as we combine trad values and an indie spirit.
Hello.
And welcome to the Hobcast Book Show, episode 118. I'm Adrian Hobart.
I'm Rebecca Collins.
And together, we run not only this podcast, the Hobcast Book Show, but also Hobeck Books, UK independent publishers of the following four genres.
Mysteries.
Suspense.
Crime.
And thrillers. And you're extremely welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us again this week. And our wonderful guest this week is Amer Anwar, who joined us from West London. And he is a CWA Dagger winner.
He is indeed. And he has lots of books.
He does. He had a fantastic collection of books behind him when we spoke to him from his West London home. But it's one of those interviews where literally we didn't say a lot because his first answer was so captivating. We were riveted. And so will you be. His path to publication is one of the most remarkable stories I think we've ever heard on this podcast.
I think it's a shame in a way it wasn't on video because we were both agog.
Yes, we were.
If you can visualise what two agog people look like,
absolutely.
That was us.
No, that was us. So Amer is our guest a little bit later. It's been a big week in the week of publishing. One that I experienced from afar here
you
in Staffordshire.
Did.
But you ventured into London.
I know. I was in the throng of the publishing world. I was at the London Book Fair at Olympia in London on Thursday.
Yeah.
I just went for the day.
Absolutely. Well, let's capture some of the spirit of it.
Can you hear that? That isn't the hubbub of Hoback Towers. It is the hubbub of the London Book Fair. And I'm here without my partner in crime just for the day because I had a couple of meetings. And only one of us could go because the cat needed someone to stay behind. And as I talk to you now, I'm walking past the Shrajar Book Authority on the left, enormous Simon & Schuster stand on the right, it's about the size of a small village, and I'm walking towards France. And I can see Germany just in the distance. That's the beauty of the London Book Fair, is you can cross continents with just a few footsteps and no passport. This place is full of books. There are books everywhere, shelves of books, yet you can't read any of them or pick any of them up. It's also full of chairs, yet you can't sit on any of them unless you're having a meeting with someone. I've been here since 12. It's now 3 o'clock and I think I've walked about 20,000 steps. So I'm quite tired and I'm missing my partner in crime. So I think I'm going to go home soon and see how he's doing with the cat.
You got back to the cat at about, and myself, about 10:30 that night. You were exhausted. You walked over 20,000 steps.
I did. I felt like the Reclaimers. Yes. And that's 5,000 miles, isn't it? Or 500 miles.
500
anyway,
miles.
Yeah, it was only 10 miles. I would walk 10 miles. Anyway, so yes, and I had a fantastic day. It was brilliant. It was busy. It was hectic. But there was that buzz that just makes you feel so proud to be part of an industry where people love what they're making as much as they do in publishing.
And in terms of people that we've spoken to on the podcast, who did you bump into?
Very, very briefly, Alison Jones, who we interviewed at the London Book Fair last year. We exchanged a quick hug and a let's talk later, but never got round to it. And Rachel McLean as well, bumped into the ladies' loos. Which is fab. And we had a little chat outside. She's doing wonderful things with her books. She's looking into small print runs and how to the logistics of how to manage that as an independent author. So that was quite an interesting chat with her as well. Mm. From afar, I saw Mark Stay. He was giving, he was on a panel, or he was the moderator of a panel.
Yes.
And then Mark Dawson smiling at the KDP stand as well. I saw him.
Yes, with his brilliantine teeth.
His brilliantine teeth, yes.
Yes, fresh back from New York, where he had been enjoying part of his 50th birthday celebrations. It's been, clearly a huge event, London Book Fair. And personally, as you will have heard last week, I was quite relieved not to go. I find it very challenging.
But did you not, when I was sending you pictures and messages, did you not have that sort of feeling of, oh?
Well, no, I mean, you know, let's be honest. London Book Fair is a great event in need of some seating.
Well, it's one of the big ironies of the place is it's full of chairs, yet you can't sit on them unless you have a meeting.
Exactly. Yeah, it's only for those with appointments. but no, I didn't miss it at all. And I think there's some interesting things that have emerged from it. I think everyone was saying that this year's London Book Fair had got its buzz back because last year it was still in the shadow of COVID a little bit, and we caught COVID while we were there.
We did, and I don't think I have COVID. I don't feel ill or anything, no. So fingers crossed.
And the talk, this is according to the article in the bookseller. I'm sorry, I just yawned heavily. I've been out teaching my son to drive today, and I'm absolutely exhausted. That was a really big gap, wasn't it? The fact is that, you know, they're talking about the impact of artificial intelligence on the publishing industry and price pressures, and how particularly if you're doing print books, the whole price model has been ripped up by the cost of printing.
I actually caught the tail end of an interesting talk. So you know how when we go to London Book Fair, they do talks in the independent author section, but there were also talks in other parts of the London Book Fair, and you can just walk in and sit down like you can with the independent author one. And I caught the tail end of a talk which was about diversity and encouraging writers from underrepresented backgrounds and minorities. And what was interesting though was that the one of the speakers was saying, this is fine and great, but you've got to start really young. If you want people to believe that they can write and to give them the skills in order to write their stories, then you've got to go back to education and encourage it as a, you know, right at the beginning. And I thought that was actually, that's how I feel about the whole, you know, encouraging.
Well, I mean, it's going to be interesting, let's say in 20 years' time, because certainly in the UK, the way that creative writing is now so prescriptive, because let's be honest, creative writing kind of dries up in secondary school.
Yeah.
But in primary school, they're encouraged to think about all these different constructions and throwing in as many adjectives and adverbs as possible. They're actually not really learning anything about style, realistically. They're actually, you know, they're cramming in as many words and they're told to lengthen sentences where possible and all this sort of stuff to do well in their SATs. And I don't think that's really great, you know, it's not really building a passion for literature or for reading in the young.
Well, that's what this person was saying. She was saying not only is it not encouraging people from underrepresented backgrounds, it's everybody is being, their creativity is being dampened by this need to pass tests in a certain prescriptive way, like you describe.
Well, isn't it interesting? I mean, you know, because I think what Emma is going to talk to us about in our interview is one of the great examples of how this is somebody who's clearly creative, didn't do spectacularly well academically. That's not really his sort of background. From Southall, you know, a bit of a lad, he was saying, you know, and drifted through a few jobs before finding some, you know, employment as a creative person. But in terms of writing a novel, he never had anybody to look up to from his background in Southall, the South Asian community, to inspire him to think that he could do it. And then when he did submit a book, which subsequently won awards and was nominated, you know, was in newspaper lists for the best books of the years in which he was published, he faced rejection from all the major publishers, even though he had an agent, because at that stage, just a few years ago, they were not actively looking for people with diverse backgrounds. And he was being told, basically, that the people who buy books in this country won't be interested in reading a story based in this community.
Mm.
And how wrong they were, and how wrong and how much things have changed all of a sudden in publishing, but only because they finally figured out that they should be ashamed that they were treating people like Amir the way they were.
Yes, but it's a lot of change very quickly, and I think it's got to be put very early on so that it makes sense to have the change, if you know if that makes sense. I don't know, but
yeah, okay. I mean, you know, it's as he says. I mean, we put that question to him, and he says, "Look, any shift in the publishing industry is welcome."
Mm, indeed.
But you know, the question we've always had on this program is just how sincere is it, and how much of it is virtue signaled.
If they are sincere and if they mean what they're saying, then they have got to push for more change on a macro level.
Right. Now, I mean, we're talking about AI, and I was listening to another podcast, a very popular podcast, the Creative Pen podcast, presented by Joanna Penn, and she had just got back from 20 books in Seville. And this is an organisation run by Michael Andelay, who created 20 books to 50K on the basis that if you wrote 20 books, you could easily make 50K in revenue. That's not necessarily the case anymore, but it nonetheless is a very popular forum for talking about the future of publishing. And he has a publishing company and has published last year 350 books. And his target for this year was to get 700 out from his authors. He changed that as a result of the his understanding of what ChatGPT-4, this new version of AI open source programming, can do for the creative process. And he now wants to release 10,000 books this year.
Blimey. I'll see anything I can say to that.
Which is basically by teaching the machine to write novels for you.
Oh, God. Who wants to read that, though?
Well, that's the big question.
I don't want to read books created by AI. I just don't.
I've just had a book delivered from about ChatGPT-4, and it is partially written by the program itself, or the system itself, along with a human interactive.
Do you know what? It would be quite a fun challenge if somebody submitted to us a book and just said, this is my submission. And then after we read it, and if, assuming we reply and say, yeah, we love it, can we have the full manuscript? And they went, ha ha, it's written by GPT-4,
yeah. Well, look, I think this is really interesting crossroads we're at now, where the enthusiasts are saying that it's now turning out books which are perfectly publishable within 3 hours, if you, as long as you teach it to think in along the right lines and show it examples of good crime writing, for instance.
3 hours? Oh, dear. Well, that's depressing, isn't
why,
it?
Why don't we, as a podcast, experiment with it and see whether there's any veracity in this?
Okay. What are you proposing?
I don't know. Yet.
Oh, we'll have a think about
it. Have a think about it. And we've got something very exciting for you a little later in the programme after our interview with Amir. Last week we did something on the Archers. We did a little spoof, a little bit of fun, and it went down really well. A lot of people commenting positively about our bit of fun. We're going to spoof another bit of BBC content.
Yeah, something we watch a lot, but we're not going to say what, though,
no,
are we?
No, we're not.
So you have to keep listening because it's going to be worth it.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, another major development this week, and this is something that we were suggesting that small presses like us should be doing, and we've been beaten to the punch a little bit by seven largely London-based publishers, some of whom we know.
Yes.
Arenda being one of them. Karen Sullivan, and the others are Cambry Press, Fairlight Books, Jacaranda Books, who are very well known now, Legend Times, Muswell Press, Arenda, as I mentioned, and Wild Things Publishing. And they are joining forces together to create a new organisation called the Small Press Alliance, the SPA, and they're offering each other mutual support amid a quickly changing market. And the most of the challenges they're facing are post-pandemic as supply costs spiral. And there's a long, long article here with lots and lots of quotes from all the different people thing. But shall I just read out the one from Karen?
Yeah, because we know Karen.
Yeah. In an increasingly challenging industry, it makes sense to join forces with like-minded small publishers to amplify our voices, use our collective energy, insights and passion for mutual benefit, and to offer support to one another and this part of the industry as a whole. Small presses face difficult times, but together we can create a platform to sustain this immensely important part of the publishing ecosystem. Well, look, I think we'll bring this up, you know, if we see Karen at an event in the next few months and see whether Hoback has a home there too, because I think that you can do that in London, but I think there's plenty of small presses out in the sticks like us.
I think we should do a Midlands one, actually. I think we should get together with some of the other publishers based in the Midlands.
Okay.
And have a sort of a, you know, a Midlands press alliance.
Maybe we should. But look, I applaud the thing, and I think they do pick out the, you know, members of the IPG as well, a lot of the members of this new organisation, but the IPG, the Independent Publishers Guild, isn't quite focusing on our end of the market.
Well, I think the difference with the IPG is also that it's not just publishers. So it's anyone who is an independent worker within the publishing industry. So, for example, Alison Owen, who I work for, she offers consultancy services to academic publishers, and she's a member of the IPG. You also get
Bloomsbury, a part of the IPG.
Bloomsbury, a part of the IPG, but also self-publishing providers of all sorts of shapes and sizes as well. So it's
print solutions and all sorts of
things. Yes, yes.
I think there is a need for a collective work. I mean, let's just monitor situation and see how things develop. But as I say, there's so much churn and change in the industry at the minute that it's difficult to figure out what path to take in future. But we will continue, as we will discuss later in the programme, to keep looking for talented authors to join the Hoback team.
Yes, we are currently looking at submissions, aren't we? So
we are. Okay, well, let's get to our interview, shall we? Because it's an absolute doozy. We had a fantastic time talking to Amer Anwar, and he has a remarkable story of perseverance and chutzpah and creativity to get himself to the position he is now. He won the debut Dagger in 2018, I think it was, at the CWA. Maybe even earlier than that,
yeah,
actually. I lost the chronology of that. But from that, he got an agent, and he just submitted the first 3,000 words he'd written of a crime novel. And immediately agents took interest. But the trouble was, he hadn't written any more.
Yeah, so it's quite funny.
It took him about 5 years to finish that first book. And then he had an agent but couldn't find a publisher, so he published it himself. And, well, let's let
it's
him
a good
pick up
story.
The story.
It's
a brilliant story.
It's worth listening to.
And this is a fantastic interview. So let's speak to Amer Anwar.
Well, we're delighted to be joined by Amer Anwar from his home in London. Welcome to the Hobcast.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be here.
We've really been looking forward to this interview, an opportunity to speak to you, because your career has been extraordinary in the sense of the point to which you became an author has, you know, been a path of many, many different things, many, many different jobs.
Yeah.
So take us through that sort of iteration and that journey that you've been on to get to this point.
Well, I think the reason it was such a long journey is because I never actually thought that I would ever be a writer, even though from a very young age, I loved to read. I didn't see people from my sort of background as writers, so I never thought it was something I could do. I mean, I always sort of harbored that dream. Always thought, oh, I'd love to write a book. I love reading all sorts of things, and I would love to be able to do that, but I just didn't think it was something I could do. So it was never really on the radar. But I was always sort of kind of creative, so I went into other sort of creative fields. When I left college, I wanted to do photography, but there was a recession on, so everyone was firing and no one was hiring. So, you know, that proved very difficult. And then I did lots of other jobs just to sort of tide me over. And I was sort of working freelance in comic books. And I sort of felt, well, people sort of noticed early on that my handwriting was really really good. And they said, well, you can do the lettering for comic books because that's quite a sort of niche skill.
Yeah, I didn't know they had people do that.
Well, yeah, well, before the advent of computers taking it all over, it was all done by hand. So, yeah, I started sort of doing that freelance. And so I was lettering all the speech balloons and doing the sound effects and things in comic books for
boom and bam.
Yeah, all that kind of stuff. And that was good fun. And I was doing, you know, other bits of sort of artwork and stuff like that freelance. But then, you know, that obviously that wasn't sort of paying enormously well. So loads of other sort of jobs doing whatever, as we sort of mentioned earlier, driving emergency doctors around, working in warehouses. And, you know, I eventually got a job working as a chalet rep in the French Alps. Learned how to snowboard, spent a whole winter there. Good fun. But just, I think the sort of things that creative people do, I think writers and actors and people like that, while they're sort of resting in between jobs, as it were, or sort of striving to find the right sort of situation. And for me, what happened is I came back from working in the Alps and I needed a job, and I managed to blag my way into a printing company. And because I bought a computer before I went away, but I didn't really know how to use it. And I had a couple of beginner's books on some of the software, and I sort of managed to sort of fudge the interview and I got the job. And then, you know, it was very soon became apparent I didn't really know that much. But fortunately, I picked these things up very quickly. And so, you know, within a short sort of space of time, I picked up what I needed to know, and I sort of ran with that. And that was very technical, and I was quite creative. So gradually all the creative jobs, you know, designing logos and letterheads and stationery and stuff like that, leaflets for people, I was sort of getting those jobs. And then I sort of transitioned from there to another company, which was specialized in sort of DVDs and CDs and stuff. So I was working on film covers and things like that. And then gradually I started working for the big film studios, and, you know, I was doing things like James Bond covers and Captain America and stuff like that. And so I really enjoyed that. For me, you know, it was creative. It was good fun. There was no heavy lifting after all those warehouse jobs. So
I
really enjoyed that. And it didn't really feel like work because it felt like sort of just sort of playing about on the computer. Yeah. And I used to, you know, have headphones on, listen to music, chat to the other guys in the studios. So, yeah, it was very kind of relaxed and stuff. But in the back of my mind, there was still always this thing, I'd love to write a book. But I think I'd sort of shoved it way to the back and thought, oh, you know, if it ever happens, I'll be sort of in my dotage, sort of retired and loads of spare time. And then, you know, thinking of having a crack at it. But through working in the sort of art field and stuff, when the internet really sort of took off, I thought it'd be useful to know a little bit about web design. So I did a couple of courses, like evening courses, and they finished. And I found after all those years of bunking off at school, I thought, oh, I actually quite enjoy like being in a classroom and learning something new. And so those had finished. I was looking at a prospectus for something else to sort of do. And there was an introduction to writing fiction class. And I thought, oh, wow, you know, always wanted to have a go at that. So why not do that? And so I signed up for the class. I started doing it. And at the beginning, we were just writing like 1,000 words, sort of short stories. And we really was sort of like snippets. And but I, you know, had a deadline every week to write something, and then sometimes you'd read it out in class and stuff. And I found I really enjoyed it. And more importantly, the feedback I got from others in the class was really good, because I was writing these short little adventure stories. And so that sort of kind of gave me a little bit of impetus. And when that course finished, the tutor said, look, if anybody wants to take it further, it was allied with Birkbeck, which was part of the University of London. And there was a 2-year graduate course. And so the introductory course that I'd done that had some like CAT points, which counted towards like a qualification. And I thought, okay, great. the course finished sort of March, and I thought I'd, you know, after that I was ready to write a novel, but, you know, soon found I wasn't. And I thought, well, I need another course would be really useful just for me. Not that I had to, not that anyone has to sort of do a writing course, but I think for me, I needed that sort of momentum, a bit of a push and some deadlines and things like that to make me write, because I wasn't really used to the whole writing thing. I wasn't somebody who had been writing forever since I was a kid. I mean, I'd written stories when I was really young, but then, you know, once you're in high school, it's all sort of essays and stuff like that. The whole creative aspect of writing just kind of fell by the wayside. So I signed up for this course. It was 2 years. And the first year we did different things. So we did fiction, drama, poetry, and critical theory. To this day, I still don't really understand critical theory, so don't no, ask me.
I'm with you. A broad church of things.
Yeah, it was. And funnily enough, I actually enjoyed all of the different aspects, and I got really good kind of like comments from the tutors. And the poetry, I really thought I wasn't going to enjoy it, but I really did. And I got really good sort of feedback on my poetry and on the drama as well. And I really enjoyed it. But for me, it was always about fiction and writing books. And in the second year, you picked one. So I picked fiction. And at the beginning of that second year, the tutor said, what do you hope to get out of this year? And I straight away said, I want to write a crime thriller and I want to be published. And she was like, okay, that's very definite. So why don't you start writing this book now? And I thought, well, I don't think I'm ready. And she said, well, how will you know when you're ready? Well, that's a good point, because I could be writing short stories for like the next 20 years or something. And she said, you're in this class for a year. You can start writing. You can workshop it, get feedback, improve it. And by the end of the year, you'll have the start of your novel. So I thought, okay, that sounds like pretty good advice. So that's what I did. It took me a couple of attempts, because I think I was sort of trying to force it too much. And it just felt quite stilted. When I read it back, I was like, no, this is terrible. This is not how I kind of envisage that the writing should be. And so what I did is I went back. I'm a massive Elmore Leonard fan. So I read an Elmore Leonard book, but this time, normally when I read Elmore Leonard, I just sort of like sink into it and forget everything else. But I made a conscious effort to like really analyze it and make notes, and, you know, how he sort of structured the story and stuff like that, and his use of language and everything. So I was sort of really studying that. And at the same time, I watched Payback, the movie with Mel Gibson, and like I really liked that movie, and it just happened to be on TV, I think, and I watched it again. And I think the combination of that movie and the Elmore Leonard kind of came together in my head, and I had another crack at writing the opening. And this time when I read it back, I was like, that's not bad. Like, this is sort of what I'm aiming for. It had, you know, the voice and the tone was a lot better. And then so I wrote, I think it was like the 3,000 words. I submitted it to the class, and the feedback was really good. I mean, it wasn't perfect. It still needed a lot of work. You know, it was a lot of repetition and stuff like that. And I think as a sort of novice author, you tend to over-explain things. So I was guilty of that. And so I sort of workshopped it a few times in the class and improved it. And then by this point, because the course had started in September, so by this point we were getting to December. Now, I'd heard about the Crime Writers Association Debut Dagger Award, but I'd never had anything to submit. I always thought, oh yeah, I'll do something and send it off, and I didn't have anything. And then here I had this first chapter, and I thought, all right, great, you know, I'm quite pleased with this. I'm just going to send it off, ostensibly to get my first rejection. I thought, you know, because I'd read On Writing by Stephen King, you know, he had hundreds of rejections. Yeah. And I thought, well, I need to get used to this. You know, rejection is part of the journey. I need to develop a thick skin, and, you know, so I don't burst into tears every time somebody says no. So, yeah, I entered the competition and then just didn't think anything more of it. And I think in sort of January, February, I was looking at applying for MAs in creative writing, just because I kind of enjoyed that whole thing. And I didn't know any writers, so it was great to be in a group with other people who were writing. You know, you can talk writing and all that kind of stuff. You know, they understand the struggle and the woes and stuff like that, whereas you my mates would just look at me going, what are you going on about? So I was applying for an MA, and then I got a letter sort of, I think it was late February or something. And I thought it was from one of the universities that I'd been applying to. And I opened it up, and it was from the Crime Writers Association. And it said, congratulations, you've been shortlisted. So out of hundreds and hundreds of entries, I'd made the top 10, or was it 12 that year? I can't remember. And I was blown away. I thought, wow.
I bet, yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I thought, wow. So when I eventually finish writing this book and start sending it to agents, I can say, well, I was shortlisted for this sort of, you know, really prestigious major award. So I was chuffed with that. And as part of being shortlisted, you get invited to the actual award ceremony, which was in central London, Park Lane, in a hotel, black tie. So I went along. This was in July, not thinking anything of it. And yeah, and there was all these like famous crime writers. And I was like, wow, I never thought I was going to be in this sort of situation. And just sort of like it happening sort of, so it seemed quite quickly really at that point. And, you know, there was dinner and there was drinks. And I thought, well, you know, how often is this going to happen? I might as well make the most of it. So I was the wine waiter's best friend that night. I mean, every time, every time I saw him coming close by, I was sort of like finishing off my drink and sort of, oh yeah, yes, please.
Give me more.
Yeah. So, and then they were announcing the awards then after dinner, and the debut dagger being sort of like the smallest of the awards for an unpublished author. That was the first one that was up. And people had come over from abroad as well, from Spain and Canada and stuff like that. And they read out the shortlist and they said, and the winner is Amar Anwar. So I'd only gone and won the bloody thing. And like completely unexpected.
And you hoped for a rejection as well.
Well, that's why I'd entered, and expecting a rejection. And obviously if I'd known I was going to win, I may have gone easier on the wine as well. So
brilliant.
So I had to sort of, you know, get up and make a conscious effort to walk in a straight line to get on the stage and accept the award and sort of, you know, quickly sort of thank whoever I could think to thank at that point, and then left the stage as quickly as possible. And it was very surreal. And I was, you know, people, as I was walking back to my table, it was all these like famous authors congratulating me. And I was like, oh my God, this is like so like a dream. And then I sat down, and then there was drinks afterwards and stuff like that. And then the next day I was contacted by four agents. And they'd obviously, they read the because the debut dagger is for the first sort of 3,000 words or 3,500 words of a novel. And so they'd read that, and they were saying, oh, can we read the rest of the manuscript? And of course, I never expected to win or anything. So I hadn't even finished the book. And so I was like, well, I haven't actually written it. And I think after that, they sort of changed the rules to stipulate you need to have finished the book. So that, you know, you've got something for the agents to look at straight away. But yeah, total kind of never even expected it. So didn't even worry about having a completed book at that point. So I told three of the agents, look, I haven't finished writing it yet. And they said, well, OK, when you finish it, then send it along to us. But one agent said, well, OK, that doesn't matter. I still want you to sign with me. And then when you finish it, you can send it to me. And so I was like, okay. So I looked up the agent, and it was Jane Gregory. So Val McDermid's agent, Belinda Bowers, a whole host of, you know, best-selling crime writers. And I thought, well, I'm not going to say no. So, because this is, you know, one of the top agents in the country. So I signed with Jane, and then she said, okay, great. So how long do you think it's going to take you to finish writing this book? Now, as a complete novice, I'd never even attempted writing a book before. So I had no idea how long it would take. And I don't think I'd even read about how long these things would take. So I just sort of thought, what's a suitably longish amount of time? And so I said 6 months. And Jane didn't bat an eyelid. And so she probably thought, wow, he can write two books a year at this rate. That's great.
Yeah, she was in flashes of...
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, it was 5 years before I sent her a draft that I was happy with. And
but you weren't very popular then.
Well, I mean, she would check in with me every so often. You know, are you still alive? Are you still writing? How's it going? Sort of thing. And I was like, yeah, I'm still writing. You know, it's going okay. You know, I'm getting there. But she didn't sort of hassle me. But then the thing is, after that, a lot of people said, wow, I'm really surprised that she didn't just sort of drop you. It took 5 years, but she didn't. So I guess, you know, she must have been quite sort of keen on the book and seen the potential in the writing or something. I mean, at any rate, her confidence really kept me going as well, because when it got really difficult, there were times when I thought, what the hell am I doing? You know, I could be down the pub or I could be having, you know, watching TV or doing something much easier than putting myself through this, you know, spending so much time working on the book. And the trouble is, my friends will sort of tell you that I'm a bit of a perfectionist as well. So it had to be right for me before I could send it anywhere. So hence the 5 years. And then I finally sort of sent it to Jane, thinking, all right, I've nailed it. This is it. And of course, then I got an email back a few weeks later. And the first paragraph was like, really well done. You've finished writing the book. There's some, you know, great scenes, great setting, dialogue, this and that. But, and then there was this lengthy email just sort of like explaining what was wrong with it and what I needed to fix. So yeah, I was a bit, oh, okay. After 5 years, there's still, and it was still quite a lot of work. I mean, it wasn't like loads of nitpicking, but it was kind of things like the main character's motivation wasn't strong enough. But to address that, I had to rewrite the whole book, because everything he thought and did had to change to strengthen his reasoning for doing stuff. I mean, it did make it a much better book as well, because as I thought about it and I thought, yeah, you know, this would happen, and the whole thing got slightly darker, I think, whereas I think it had been a bit, perhaps a bit too light, maybe a bit flippant. And yeah, as it got darker, I think it was more sort of what I wanted it to be as well. So I did one more, like a really major rewrite of it, and then it went back, and then it went through just a couple of sort of fairly light edits, which were just sort of like details and things like that. And then I didn't hear back for a while. So I got in touch with Jane again. I was like, is everything okay? You know, are there any more amends coming? And there'd been a bit of a mix up between the edit, because Jane has an editor who works for her and Jane herself. And they'd sort of, one had gone on holiday and then the other had gone on holiday, and both of them had thought that they'd told me that the book had gone out on submission, but nobody had. So then they said, oh, you know, it's been out on submission for a couple of weeks. Then I was like, oh my God, I didn't even know it was ready to go out. So then it was a case of waiting for, you know, feedback, and fingers crossed I'd get a deal. And the book went out, I think about sort of 30 or so, you know, imprints and editors and publishing houses, and it got rejected by every single one of them.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Wow wasn't the word I used, but
no. No, I mean, that's dark.
Yeah. But the thing was that the feedback was really good. And so that was a bit confusing. So, you know, they were saying things like, oh, the writing's really good, the setting's great, characters are good, the action's good, the dialogue. You know, all these, and I was thinking, hang on a minute, well, what more do you want in a crime thriller if it's got all those elements? But there's always kind of like a little but, you know, oh, we don't think we have the right mission plan for it, you know, it doesn't quite fit our list. And then I think the most telling one was where one editor had said, I can't quite visualize this appealing to a broad audience. Now, the book is set in West London, in the Asian community. All the characters are Asian, and there's a lot of Asian references and stuff like that. And I think taking all of that feedback together and reading between the lines, I kind of suddenly got what that broad audience was, what they meant by that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so did Jane. And she was like, she was so apologetic. And I thought, well, it's not your fault, because she was really sort of championing it and pushing it. And she couldn't believe that people were turning it, that they'd turned it all down. So I kind of went away. And then Jane said, look, I'm really sorry. You know, maybe just put it in a drawer and start on something else. And maybe with the next book, we'll have a bit more luck. But I think what's sort of stuck with me was the fact that all the feedback had generally been very good. Mm. I mean, if they'd said, look, the writing's not quite there, or the book as a whole doesn't work, or anything like that, then I may have thought, well, okay, I still need to improve as a writer. But all the sort of ingredients of the book were there, and they'd said it was good, but they didn't want to publish it. So I think that really sort of got my back up a little bit.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I'd been reading about self-publishing. I never thought it was something I would do. But then I decided, you know what? I think I want to get this book out there and just see what actual readers think of it. So, and as I said earlier, I'm a bit of a perfectionist. So I spent 6 months on social media, basically watching how the big publishing houses launched their books. Mm. And making notes, and I, you know, all the graphics they did. So my background is art and design. So if I saw a graphic that I thought, wow, that looks really good, I would copy it and then use it as a template and create my own, very similar. And I bought my own ISBN numbers. I created my own barcodes. I designed my own cover. I formatted my own ebook. I learned how to typeset, which was a skill I didn't have, and I typeset the book for paperback. And I went to Clay's, who are the big book printers who print for a lot of the big publishers, and I set up an account with them, and I had them print my paperbacks. Mm. So I took the copyright page from a Lee Child novel and just changed it. I set up a fake publishing company with a virtual office address in like central London, so it sounded really legit. I designed a fake logo to go on the spine, so when it was sat on a bookshelf, it would look
indistinguishable. Like
exactly, from a proper publishing company. I had a fake publisher and a fake publicist, and I did my own press releases and stuff.
Brilliant.
And so the paperbacks were there, and Clay's said, would you like an account with Gardeners? Now, Gardeners are big book wholesalers.
Absolutely.
Who supply Waterstones and people like that. And I said, yes, I would. I'd love an account. So they helped me set up an account, saved me a lot of the hassle of doing it. So I had an account with Gardeners, and then I sent the book to Waterstones head office, you know, obviously hoping they'd take it as core stock, which means they'd buy like a ton of them and send it to every branch in the country. But obviously they'd never heard of me or the publishing company or the book. So they didn't take it on as core stock, but what they did say, it's on the Gardeners system. So any branch that wants to order it can. So I went to every branch I could physically get to with a proof copy, because I'd had proof copies printed as well. And I went in, asked to speak to the manager, gave them a press release, a copy of the book, told them a bit about it, you know, won the CWA debut dagger. It's a crime novel, it's set in London. And, you know, to be fair, many of them would just said, oh, all right, we'll get 10 copies or we'll get 15 copies and see how it goes.
Brilliant.
So I did that in London to the branches I would get to. But on the Waterstones website, they have the email address of every store in the country. So then I was emailing press releases to branches in cities where I thought there might be an audience for the book. And then it was selling in Glasgow, in Edinburgh, and Birmingham, and places like that. So, you know, that was quite heartening. And then I'd seen that the publishers would send the book to like book bloggers to sort of initiate a bit of a buzz. So I made a list of crime book bloggers, and then I just sent them an email with the press release saying, you know, would you like a copy of this book? You know, you can have an ebook or a physical copy. And then my old boss, who'd printed my proof copies, he let me go and use his postage, like his franking machine and stuff like that. So once a week, I would go to his office and sit there just sort of like filling envelopes and sending them off. And then the reviews started to come in. And the reviews from book bloggers, from readers on Amazon, from people who'd bought it in Waterstones, I was getting 5-star reviews, and people were saying, oh, this is so unlike any other book that's out there, and it's so different. And the most heartening thing was most of the readers were from that broad audience that they were saying the book wouldn't appeal to. Mm-hmm. So, and I was like, well, okay, I'm I'm really pleased about this. So I don't actually think they were correct in their assumptions. So, you know, the book was doing fairly well. I was in it for the long haul. I thought, you know, I'm going to keep plugging away and maybe it will get some traction. I was, you know, sending it to, like, I went to Harrogate and I took a stack of the proofs and I was just foisting it upon authors and hoping they would read it and tweet about it and it might, you know, do something. And so I was always hustling at events. And the thing is, before this, I was very shy and retiring. And I would never dream of doing something like that. But I kind of had to, you know, become my own sort of champion of the book and stuff because I was doing it all solo. It was very much guerrilla publishing. And I was at one particular event in Waterstones, Piccadilly, and I'd taken a couple of copies of the book to give out. And an author called Courtney Newland, he said, there's a publisher here. I think you should meet her. And at the end of the evening, he introduced me, and it was Charmaine Lovegrove. Now, Charmaine had just set up a new imprint at Little Brown, part of Hachette, called Dialogue Books. And she was looking for the first few authors to take on. So I met her and I told her about the book and the trouble I'd had getting published and that it was a crime novel set in Southall and stuff. And she said, wow, it sounds really interesting. Can you send it to me? I said, yeah, sure. So I sent her a copy of the book. I think it was on a Thursday or a Friday. And on Monday, I got an email saying, oh, could you come in for a meeting? So, I'd had meetings before and it hadn't gone anywhere. So I wasn't sort of holding out that much hope. But I went along for the meeting and, you know, I turned up and they said, look, we love the book. We think it would really fit with our imprint. But, you know, what about your current publisher? And I said, I said, well, you're looking at him. And they were like, what? And I said, yeah, I'm the publisher. It's self-published. I did it. And they were sort of looking at this book with the, you know, the publisher's logo and all that. I said, this is you. And I went, yeah, that's all me. And I sort of told them and they were like, oh my God. And they said, okay, so there's no issues about it. I said, no, not at all. So I had to, but the thing is, I went to that meeting solo. So I got back home and then I emailed Jane and I said, look, I've just had a meeting with Dialogue Books. I think they might be interested in buying the book. And then by the end of the week, I'd signed a 2-book deal with them.
Brilliant.
So my self-published version, I had to pull from sale.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've got a couple of boxes still in the attic of the self-published version, which is a bit of a rarity now, apparently. But and then the book went through, it got a new title, a new cover. It went through another sort of edit with Dialogue. And then the following year, it came out as Brothers in Blood.
Yeah.
And it came out in September. And at the end of that year, it got really good reviews in all the national newspapers when it came out in September. But at the end of that year, it was picked by The Times and The Guardian as one of the thrillers of the year. So for a book that no publisher wanted, I suddenly felt very, very vindicated indeed. So,
I bet.
Yeah. And then the follow-up, which came out 2 years later, Stone Cold Trouble.
Yes.
Ended up, that was long-listed for the CWA Gold Dagger for Crime Novel of the Year. So quite a sort of trajectory.
Amazing.
Yeah, your story is incredible. I'm just like...
I've got to ask, this is an important question, though, given the trends within publishing now.
Yeah.
Does it anger you that publishers clearly, and publishing as an industry, has woken up to the fact that it's got a diversity issue?
Yeah.
In the people that it has hitherto been signing deals with was a certain type of person. So they were making that decision based on it didn't fit with the wider audience. And now they're all offering scholarships and, you know, conduits for people from different backgrounds that aren't represented generally as authors.
Yeah.
Opportunities. Does it please you that they've finally woken up to this, or does it anger it you to go through this hell?
No, it doesn't anger me. I mean, I'm very glad that they have now realized and things. I think with me, it was just timing. I wish they'd woken up to that a lot sooner. obviously it would have made things a lot easier for me, I think, if they'd realized that. But a lot of, you know, it is the gatekeepers. Who are the gatekeepers? What are their backgrounds? Do they necessarily connect with that story? If it's like, in particular, the book that I wrote was from that part of West London. And a lot of people, I think a lot of readers who read widely, it doesn't matter where the story's set. You're always looking for something different. You know, people read about hobbits and boy wizards and, you know, Scandinavian noir and stuff like that, which is unfamiliar and everything. But, you know, that's what readers are always looking for, something new. But I think in publishing, they're always looking for more of the same, because if they know that it sells, and I think with publishing now being so kind of run by numbers, nobody wants to take a risk. Whereas in the old days, they, you know, the big sellers would fund the sort of passion projects and stuff like that. But a lot of that now has gone from publishing. You can't have a failure because, you know, the numbers then are not in your favor.
Mm.
So I think nobody wanted to take a risk on it. And it because it was sort of different to what they would put, what was being published at that point. And also, I think, because if people aren't from that background, they're like, well, I don't really understand this. I don't get this. Will this appeal to other people? Because it feels so alien to me. I don't understand it. But then if you have diverse people working within publishing who come from a variety of backgrounds, to them, they may feel that, oh, this is an experience that is valid. I get this, and I haven't read this before. And that might make them champion a book like that much more than was otherwise the case. And so for me, it was about timing. I think I was, a couple of years too early. If I'd been doing it a bit later, I may have got like a great deal and, you know, just it would have been a lot smoother ride. But, you know, I can't. It is a great story. When I tell people the story, they're like, oh, my gosh, that's a great story. I did learn so much. Mm. I was actually a publisher for a year. And I'd sort of learned so much that I wouldn't have otherwise. Mm. And I think it gave me a kind of tenacity and drive that I would not have gained otherwise. And those are all useful things. And, you know, to then still have gone on and, you know, had a Times and Guardian Book of the Year and then been longlisted, I can't bemoan anything that's happened, because I'm very pleased with how it's kind of turned out. And I'm very pleased now that there are many more writers from diverse backgrounds, and those stories are being told, and publishing is realizing that this is important, and that readers relish these kind of new stories and voices and things like that. And it's only a good thing for publishing, because there's more scope, then there's more material, and, you know, everyone should be happy about that.
Absolutely. I started reading Stone Cold Trouble and your second book. So you took me into a scene that I'm only too familiar with, because I lived in Acton, near Acton Town Tube, at Gunnersbury. Okay. So I'm just like across the Ealing Common from Ealing and then Southall.
Yeah.
And that opening scene on presumably the North Circular, stuck in traffic around Ealing Common, been there dozens and dozens and dozens of times.
Yes.
So that took me to a place I know. But what I loved so much was your two main characters, Zach and Jags. Yeah. The way they spoke, it was very fresh, the way the dialogue works, and the dropping in of, Indian vernacular, if I can call it that. I'm trying to figure out which language it was, but nonetheless.
It's Punjabi.
Punjabi, right.
Yeah.
Punjabi dropped in, and that was, you know, rather than being off-putting, which I'm sure a lot of the people who were writing there, it was great, 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 apart from this, were thinking, it actually is very, very exciting from a reader's point of view to experience that, to feel that authenticity.
That's what I can say. It's the authenticity, isn't it? That's what I know. As a reader, that's what I want. I want an authentic.
And I was very careful not to sort of overdo it. And that there are instances, especially in the first book, where like some of the older characters will speak in Punjabi, but I always had Zach answer in English, and so you know, by his answers, you can work out what the question must have been. So you don't feel like you're missing anything out, but it's not, you know, it's not spoon feeding the reader. And I guess you kind of feel that you're sort of, you're in there and you're understanding what's going on with a greater sense of that authenticity, because you're kind of picking up on stuff.
And I love the family dynamic, you know, that I mean, clearly Southall, the South Asian community, that where you grew up, it's family is everything. But the way that you've used that as a dynamic within the story, in the sense that, and I must admit, I've only read a few pages, but I got a feeling of almost a Godfather sense of family, you know, we stick together kind of thing going on there, that you will do anything and put yourself in harm's way for the family.
Yeah, I think that is very much the case. And I think that, you know, the Godfather analogy, it is very much like that. And I think for those kind of like immigrant communities who came over and they had their family there, and often it was the family and friends were the only people they could rely on. So it's very tight knit communities there who do rely on each other. I mean, back in the day in Southall, they couldn't trust the police. You know, and the authorities were kind of just made things difficult for them and stuff like that. So they relied heavily on each other, and family was everything and is everything. So family is still very important to people from that kind of background. And so I had the characters. I mean, they're both the main characters. They've grown up here. So a lot of their influences and, you know, are very, very sort of British. And yet they have this added dimension of having the Asian background and the things that would entail, and how that sort of affects their sort of character and how they view the world and stuff.
Yeah, it's beautifully done. And
thank you.
And really refreshing. So two books published. Where are you now in terms of, you know, career development, the next book? What's the picture?
Well, I'm working on book three in the series. So another Zack and Jag's Tale. That's all sort of planned out. Unfortunately, I have a day job, which kind of gets in the way. And I have a daughter as well, who I have on the weekends. So time for writing is quite limited, which is a difficulty. But the book's all planned out. I'm sort of, you know, every chance I get, I'm trying to work on it. Really happy with the plot and the structure and how it's all worked out. So that's on the cards. After that is a standalone that was meant to be book two. So when book one didn't sell,
he mentioned that. Yeah.
And then Jane said, maybe start something else. So I came up with this idea, and it's sort of been refined over the years. But then when it did sell to Dialogue, and I said, yeah, I've got this standalone that I want to write next. And they were like, oh, can you do a follow-up? Like,
yeah. Okay,
shelved it. And then I thought I was going to do the follow-up. And they said, no, can you do a third and make it a trilogy? I'm like, okay. So I will eventually get to this standalone, which is another West London set crime thriller with sort of Asian, but a much more mixed sort of cast. I think there's so there's that. And then after that, I'm sort of toying with the idea of two historical thrillers.
Ooh.
But both set in London and both with main characters of colour, but different time periods.
What time periods are you thinking? Can we ask?
You can ask, yes. So one will be set right after the end of the Second World War in London, and the other one is set during the reign of Elizabeth I.
Wow.
Yes.
Oh, that is going back quite a bit.
It is going back quite a bit. And I think, you know, they're going to take a bit of, I'm not a historian, so I'm going to have to do some research and stuff.
Yeah.
But so they will take a while, but I'm excited about the actual stories. And I, you know, people I've sort of told, you know, oh, this is what it's going to be about, they've loved it. So yeah, I think they could well be the sort of books. Will that be 5 and 6?
Yeah,
you're going to be very busy.
Yes, I know. I need to write full time.
This is
a day job, do you?
This is the issue, isn't it? I mean, at what stage can you get to that point where it is your day job? Because people have made that leap, and I just don't know how they do it. if I'm honest, because, you know, when you've got all those commitments and those time pressures,
yeah,
it seems impossible.
I think the only way to do it is just to keep writing. And either you get, you know, lucky with one, a book becomes a bestseller and you make enough that you can give up the day job, or you just keep plugging away until you have enough of a body of work that will generate enough of an income that you can give up the day job. But until then, I think it is just a case of, you know, just keep plugging away, keep writing. That's all I can do. That's all, you know, I think getting a bestseller is something akin to sort of winning the lottery. You can't sit around waiting for it because it might never happen.
Exactly.
But but there's plenty of authors who, you know, they have managed to, without being sort of household names, they've got a steady readership and they keep writing, and then they get to a point where they can give up the day job.
Yeah,
and, that would be perfect.
We know quite a few, don't we? Sort of self-published authors who aren't, they've got their readership, and a very strong readership, and they're not well known nationally, but they don't work anymore because they earn enough money. So it is possible.
Yes, definitely. But I think, putting in the work, keep writing, developing that readership, you know, that's all I can do. And then, you know, hopefully the rest will come, whether that be, you know, a book that sells extremely well, or a big increase in readership, or a film deal, or there's all sorts of things that can happen. But, you know, I think that the key is just to keep writing, do the work, put the books out there, and eventually something will happen.
Mm. I'm interested about the ecology of your sort of writing life now, in the sense that when you embarked on this journey and started taking courses, you didn't know any authors, and you also started with this position where, you know, people from your background didn't become authors. So you did the Harrogate thing, which is we know because we've done two or three now, and it is so you have to put on that shield of that sort of bravura to go and walk up to people and hand books to them. It's not easy.
What tends to happen
is there's that wagon wheel with the wagons of all the authors go around in a circle. They're all sitting there with drinks, right? And it's to go and approach that group feels so intimidating.
I need a gin and tonic before I do that. Yeah.
Well, I was just about to say, fortunately, I like a drink. So that made it a lot easier. You know, I'll have a few and then you just sort of strike up a conversation. And and I think what helped for me was I could always drop in the fact I'd won the CWA Debut Dagger, which kind of really worked in my favor. Cause you know, you're trying to foist a book on someone. They're like, oh, okay. They probably get it all the time, but when you can say, oh yeah, I actually won the Debut Dagger, then they're like, oh really? And then you've just got your sort of foot in the door. You can do the elevator pitch. Can I give you a copy of the book? And that's it. And then, you know, I wasn't pushy beyond that. It was just, you know, if they would take a copy, great, and if they wouldn't, then fine. You know, nobody owed it to me to take it or read it or anything, and I never expected that. So it was always really great when people would say yes, and fortunately a lot of authors were very kind to me and they did say yes. And you know, when Brothers in Blood was published, I had quotes on the cover from Mick Herron and Anne Cleves, amongst other people, who were both people I'd sort of foisted a copy of the self-published version on, but they were happy to support the book when it came out.
We actually had both of them on the podcast.
We have, and they're both fabulous people. But
yeah,
in terms of your social circle now, do you have a group of writing, you know, contemporaries?
Your writing buddies that you can bounce ideas off of.
I know so many authors now. Yeah. So, you know, when I go to events now, when I go to Harrogate or other festivals, I just know so many authors to go and say hello to have chats with, to have drinks with. I mean, it's such a great feeling. And then there's, you know, other sort of Asian crime writers as well. And so I sort of get to know them, and we sort of like speak about the state of the industry and how diversity is going and all that kind of stuff. Quite sort of tongue in cheek, really. But yeah, and it's fantastic. And I sort of meet people whose books I love. I mean, just last year in September, I met Sean Cosby, who was over in London. And I was like, oh my God, I love his books. I have to meet him. And I did. So And that was really good, just hanging out and having a chat. So it's a kind of, you know, for a book fan and a sort of nerdy reader, it is really a dream come true sort of situation, you know, and being invited to like Mick Herron's book launch and stuff like that. I mean, it's just, couldn't ask for more, really.
No, he's a genius. He really is. You know, his prose is just off the scale.
And he's just such a lovely person.
He is very modest.
No, he was great for podcast, wasn't he?
His journey is not dissimilar to yours, isn't it? And in terms of, you know, the gap between starting to write,
taking
a period off, and then finally finding success is a long time. It was, you know, 20 years journey. Yeah. So, yeah.
I think that's what makes him very sympathetic, though, because he knows how hard it can be. And
And I think that goes back to what I was saying. You just got to keep doing the work. And in Mick's case, that's very much, you know, he was writing books, had a readership, but never got that sort of break. Mm. And then when it did come, now it's just really sort of come, and he's flying, and, you know, it couldn't happen to a nicer person.
Absolutely, 100%. Well, I think it is time, Amit, to hit you on a Friday evening with the toughest question in British podcasting, which is, of course, Rebecca's random question.
It's a quick question. Okay. Are you a creature of comfort, or do you like to change things up?
In terms of what? Are we talking about in writing, in reading, in
life?
In life. I don't know. There are certain things that I do like, the comfort of my room filled with books and sitting here reading. But also, I do like to change things up because, you know, variety is the spice of life. So I think I'm a bit of both, a bit of a chameleon in that respect.
That's a good way to be. Because like with Adrian, he thinks he likes the change and the spice, but you are such a routine lover. You really are, aren't you? Really, at heart.
Well, yeah. I mean, I suppose as I get to know myself better at, you know, in my 50s, and recognize that I must be to some degree autistic somewhere along the line. Yeah, I think there's probably is an element of that. But at the same time, I have a habit of, let me see, how would I describe it? Behaving badly. Well, I mean, it got me in trouble at the BBC regularly when I worked there, and you know, just saying the wrong thing, you know, with this heavy slice of irony. But of course, that doesn't work anymore in the current world. You know, it's clearly, you know, whatever you say is gospel, and therefore you're being offensive.
But as long as you're in bed by 10 o'clock,
yeah, that's true. No, I suppose as I get older, the comforts and the routine is more important to me, for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, I think so. I mean, I like my comfort. And the thing is, yeah, when you get older, you know what you like and you surround yourself with that stuff. So why would you want to sort of change it? You know, but the thing is, when you're out and about, then, you know, change is good because you're out there to experience things. But I think, yeah, having your creature comforts at home, there's nothing wrong with that.
Favorite mug and things like that.
Yep, favorite mug, you know, favorite chair, favorite blanket, favorite TV shows, all that kind of stuff. You know, you've kind of got to that point in life where you know what you like, and, you know, it makes you feel good.
Problem in our house, though, is that the favorite chair is the favorite of three people, so they fight over the favorite chair.
Yeah, I can see your eldest boy yesterday. We were watching something, I can't remember what, or was it University Challenge the other night, and I was in favorite chair, and he just looked. For about 3 minutes, he looked like thunder.
No, that's not
he
true.
He did.
No. So, well, the night before, he sat in a different chair to let you have the favourite chair. I saw him do it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, he's very wise.
My oldest boy and youngest boy, they will both try and sit on the chair with it, moving their bottoms into each other.
It's very cosy. Sounds very cosy.
They're funny that way. Oh, fantastic. This has been a wonderful interview. Thank you so much. Where can we find you online if people want to find out more about you?
So my website is www.amitanwar.com, and I'm on Twitter and Facebook, Instagram a little bit. But yeah, if anybody wants to sort of message me or anything, Twitter is usually the best place to get me, and I'm always happy to chat.
Fantastic. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you.
If you're going this year.
I am going to Harrogate. Well, I'm planning to. Yeah, I've got my hotel and train tickets all sorted and everything. So I shall be there. And if you need to find me anywhere, just look by the bar.
Oh, absolutely. Well, that's where we hang.
As well, yeah.
We'll see you there. Thank you so
much. Okay, lovely. All right. Thanks very much.
It was a brilliant way to start our Friday night talking to Amir.
Yes, it was. It was great.
It really was. Okay, look, we'd like to have a bit of fun on this programme.
We really do, every now and then.
And we like to sometimes draw inspiration from the things that we watch. And so we have decided that we're going to apply a new process to sifting through our big submissions pile.
And it's a very successful way to do it, I think.
Yeah, let's introduce you to our new way of doing things.
Hoba Chef is back.
You've reached 80,000 words. You need to submit it now. Time's running out.
That is WH Smith quality. Ah, paper cut.
With 45 of the most ambitious crime writers, all competing for a coveted place in the Hoba Chef author lineup.
That's not where you put a paragraph.
Only the best writers will make it to the literary adventures of a lifetime and the chance to meet the Hobeck Cat.
We hope you enjoyed that. We had fun making it.
It was so much fun. I think the BBC might give us a call.
Well, as you know, my ambition is to do MasterChef at some point in the near future. But I have to say, so far, watching this new series, the standard in the opening round has gone way up.
I must admit, I have noticed it's almost like you've gone a bit quiet while watching
it. I have, because honestly, the talent this year has been absolutely staggeringly good first 2 weeks. And I'm just thinking, yeah, I could see myself competing and getting an apron last year, but not this year.
It does seem to be the way with these things, doesn't it? Because, I don't know, it starts off as a way of getting ordinary people doing ordinary cooking to improve. But then they watch the show and they emulate what's on the show and then they get better. And then the next year and the next year and next year like that. So, yeah,
it's been staggering.
It's going to be tough.
Staggering, right. Well, look, in terms of our week ahead, it's, well, no London Book Fair to worry about.
Thank God. Just in terms of exhaustion.
Yeah, no, you are tired, and we all are. You know, there's lots of sort of family things going on. My son has his driving test on Thursday, so that's going to be a big day. I hope he passes. He was great today when I took him out for a couple of hours, practicing parking and all sorts of things. And so, you know, fair wind, he'll get it.
He will.
But, you know, otherwise it's another busy week at Hoback Towers. We've got the submissions to do in our new format. And would encourage you, of course, to take a good look at what we can offer as a publisher. We have our subsidiary, Arch Publishing Services, which is getting a lot of interest.
Yeah, I'm actually on another job at the moment for somebody who approached us through Arch Publishing Services.
Yeah, so we can help you get your books to print. But, of course, we have Hoback Books, and our website there is www.hoback.net. Please subscribe to this podcast if you've come across us this week and enjoyed it. We'd love you to be a regular listener. But for myself, Adrian Hobart.
And myself, Rebecca Collins.
Thanks so much for joining us, and have a wonderful and
creative
week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Hobcast from Hoback Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hoback.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hoback online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to The Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.